Welcome to Conversations for Financial Professionals, a podcast to help shape the next generation of financial advice. I'm your host, Dominique Henderson, and today's conversation is with none other than Mr. Seth Godin. And I'm so eager for you to hear this conversation where we really unpack the importance of being indispensable versus embracing mediocrity and operating in your own superpower versus being a cog in the big machine of life. We also cover the topic of patience and its importance on your journey wherever you may find yourself as a career changer, as an existing financial professional, or as an aspiring financial professional. And make sure you stay tuned all the way to the end for Seth's advice to all financial planners out there. This is one for the ages, and I know you're going to love this conversation on uncovering your superpower and becoming indispensable to your ideal client. Let's head to the conversation. Welcome to another episode of Conversations for Financial Professionals, a podcast where we are shaping the next generation of financial advice. And I am very privileged today. We got Mr. Seth Godin. You are a multi-world time bestseller, including titles like Purple Cow and Linchpin and now The Practice. You are only or one of three people, I think, in the Direct Marketing Hall of Fame. But to be quite honest, in my opinion, you're just one of the world's best educators and teachers of what I feel is lacking, which is confidence.
Wow. Very kind of you. And it's a pleasure to be here. I think this topic matters, and I'm glad to chime in.
Yeah. Uncovering your superpower and becoming indispensable. Let me first ask, we're kind of closing out another year. 2020 is going to be behind us in about 48 hours or so. Do you do anything that's, like a special routine or anything like that at this time of year?
A long time ago, I decided that resolutions don't work and they don't make me feel better either. And so instead, what I try to do is not wait till the end of the year, but on a regular basis, sometimes every day, ask myself two questions. One, was this worth doing? And two, did I keep the promises I made to the people I made them to?
I like that. I love that. Will that fall in line with one of these? I don't know. I think I can't remember the address of this podcast, but I was recently listening to something you said, and I think this may be along the line of maybe personal disciplines. So maybe you can opine on this for a couple of minutes, but you don't watch TV, you don't eat meat, and you don't do meetings. I'm like, man, I do all three of those things. So
you're doing fine. Don't worry.
Very good. Very good. Well, let's kind of break into this today. I wanted to kind of discuss some themes of your writings and things that I guess, kind of show up over and over again, or maybe kind of permeate. And that's the notion around being indispensable versus embracing mediocrity. Mm-hmm. And maybe operating in your superpower versus just being a cog in the big machine of life. So, like, how did you happen upon these concepts? Where did they come from? Give me the evolution of this kind of thinking in your regard.
Yeah, it's a super question. What do I mean when I talk about being indispensable? Because no one is actually indispensable. The planet keeps turning, even if you don't get out of bed. What I'm getting at is seeking out the feeling that you are doing something specific, that you are putting yourself on the hook, that you are a unique entity that would be missed if you were gone. And that is the opposite of what we are taught in school. And so I pushed against it all the years I was coming up. And then I was surrounded by people who were younger than me, saw it happening over and over again. The kids want to find a path and a voice and an impact, but the system keeps pushing them to fit in. The number two pencil, the standardized test, the little circles, the famous college. I could go on forever. Why does the system want that? Well, I spent more than a year of my life researching it. We invented school to make factory owners happy. That is its purpose. It was stated purpose. The first school for teachers in Massachusetts was called the Normal School, because its job was to teach kids to be normal. And I don't think we need more people who will work cheaper and follow instructions better. We don't have a shortage of that. You might have argued in 1800 or 1900 we did, And a lot of injustice has happened in this world against people's will, pushing them to be compliant cogs in the system, whether they want to or not. But now in 2021, I think it's pretty clear that's not going to get us where we want to go. We need individuals who have something to say and who would be missed. So the more I researched it, the angrier I got, because I started to see something I hadn't seen before. And I wanted to share that thinking with people. And what I'll tell you is most people say, yeah, I'd like to be indispensable. But then when I say, show me the places where you are leaning against the system, insisting for your own voice, they can't show me because they're filled with fear, because that's what they got indoctrinated to do.
Wow. That's real powerful. Before I ask a follow-up question to that, did you have a influence that kind of steered you to that path? Like maybe a parent or a teacher or anybody?
Well, I think I probably had two influences. The first one is I have a mild but productive case of ADHD, and I have a lot of trouble sitting still. And then I won the parent lottery. I was born with privilege. And I was born with two amazing parents who understood who I was and didn't encourage me to be weird, but they tolerated me being weird. And that was all I needed, was to know that someone had my back. And that's too rare in our world. And I miss them every day.
I would agree with that. So I'm going to borrow a phrase from Shane Parrish. Let's double click on that. Let's peel back the onion just a little bit. So I'm of the persuasion, I think our culture is really fascinated with the concept of like having superpowers. But the reality of operating in your superpower means that you have to actually cultivate something. You don't even superheroes. Let me rephrase it. I think people are fascinated with the notion of being a superhero. But to actually work on cultivating your superpower, that's something different. Is this the notion around, shipping something? You've used this concept before, and actually let's call it Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours that allow you to be an expert. Unpack that a little bit about the differences between loving the superhero life, but actually cultivating the superpower.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is the sweet spot for me. I'm looking over on my bookshelf. There's the Fantastic Four, the Green Arrow, Spider-Man, Superman. I've got Black Panther over there, the whole Marvel universe. I'm very into this. But the Justice League of America is where we're going for our conversation today.
Okay.
So the Justice League consisted of a clubhouse where Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and a few others would hang out. And then some weird person would show up with some weird power and they'd haze them for a little while. And there'd be some adventure where only they could solve the problem, right? And what it teaches us, among many other things about generosity, is what it teaches us is that they're not doing anything that they can outsource, right? Mm. They're not washing the dishes. They're not doing their bookkeeping. They're not wondering about the size of their logo. That the logo discussion is a great example of this. If your superpower is that you're able to look at a spreadsheet and decide and discover the truth, then you have no business weighing in on the logo. Because the logo of your company is better handled by somebody who knows what they're doing, not just because you have the power to speak up. And so we push ourselves to be wandering generalities, as Zig Ziglar would say, because that lets us off the hook. It keeps us interested, as opposed to being a meaningful specific. And what it would mean if you're a financial advisor and you wanted to have a superpower is you have to fire a third of your clients and you have to turn away a third of the people who ask you to work with them. Turn them away with generosity to someone who can serve them better. Because finding your smallest viable audience, being specific about what you do and who you do it for, that's what superheroes do. That is what it means to have a superpower, to say no.
No, I love that because it reminds me of Gail Hendricks' Big Leap, the zone of excellence and the zone of genius, really, that everybody strives towards. But most of our lives, we live our, for the purpose of the people listening to this podcast, don't see my hands, but we're living in that lower hemisphere of zone of incompetence and zone of competence. And so I love that because and you're getting into a subject that I want to talk about, which is So this notion that you put forth in Lynchpin about the industrial machine that is public education, very, very similar to the financial services industry, where they make us look all like one, you know, gallon of milk. We're all homogeneous. And talk about some of the ways maybe that, or maybe specifically, a financial professional could use a year like the pandemic to either help them break out of that, or maybe from a different angle, slightly different angle. Do you think that something like the pandemic has maybe sped up or slowed down this dismantling of these industrial machine systems that spit out cogs?
Okay, well, let me dive in on the first one first. Okay. So if you make average stuff for average people, then the only way that you can go forward is hoping to be found more often than the other average people. The only way you can go forward is assuming that you're smarter than your customers when it comes to who they're going to pick. Because if you're giving average financial advice to average people, well, then I should just hunt for someone who's going to charge lower fees and make me one more basis point. Because you've already announced to me who you are, right? Whereas if you are specific, and I had a friend years ago who was a financial advisor only to violinists, clarinetists, and viola players in symphony orchestras. That's all he did. Well, you could go find someone else, but you can't find someone else who knows everything I know about 1099s, about this, about this, about this in your industry. Because I can make one phone call to someone who has interacted with a dozen of my clients who already knows who I am, because you all have something in common. That's my superpower. That doesn't mean I'm Warren Buffett. It just means I am specific. And it's super difficult. You know, part of what led many people to become financial advisors is it's sort of easy to get into it, right? That there's a path. It's a lot of work, but there's a path. And that's part of the problem, because it doesn't create a scarcity of the generic kind. Easy in, easy out. And what you instead want to do is say, what am I going to sign up to do that's really hard to do? That's demonstrably valuable and really specific and hard to do. And one of the advantages I think that the pandemic had, it had so few, is you can't go to the country club and you can't glad hand your way to a new client. I don't think that's a reliable, scalable way to get new clients anyway. But now going forward, what's really obvious is new clients are going to come when your existing clients tell other people. And the question I would ask you is, why on earth would they tell somebody else about you? Because it's super risky to recommend an average financial planner to your friends. Because if they're simply average, now your friendship is in danger, because now you're responsible for the things that came. That what you want is to recommend something that you have to whisper about, because you don't want the word to get out too much. And where your life will get better if other people in your circle know about it. That's not easy to do, but it is totally doable. And that is where how you get to the other side.
No, I love that. So let's, if you don't mind saying, like, this whisper quality for your financial professionals, is this something that you found in your financial professional, or do you even work with somebody? Like, maybe kind of give us a wish list of something that you're kind of looking for when you work with someone.
Well, so I've been working with the same person for 25 years. And 20 years. And I found out about him because one of the most important venture capitalists in America, who I trust and is a dear friend, I said, who do I hire, Fred? And Fred told me. And if Fred told me, I just don't need to spend a lot of time looking around. And then in the difficult moment early in our interaction, when it would have been easy for him to say, I can't do that, my guy did something. And I said, I'm in it for good now, because when there was nothing at stake for you, you showed up. And, you know, I know I can just go to Vanguard and I can probably demonstrate financially that makes more sense. But I don't think that's what financial advisors do. I think financial advisors are in the business of working with our emotions and the story we tell ourselves about money, not in getting us more basis points, because I'm pretty much an efficient market theorist on that one.
Hey, Dominique here. I just wanted to take a moment to tell you about my Jumpstart Group Coaching Program. If you're an aspiring financial professional looking for more context, insight, and perspective for the questions you're asking about how to get started in this industry, then you need to register for Jumpstart Group Coaching. You can activate your 7-day free trial, which gives you instant access to all the previous calls and lots of other extra brain food to accelerate your journey as you learn more about where your place is in this industry. Just go to www.jumpstartcoachinglab.com and click on Jumpstart Programs and Services to get started. Now back to our conversation.
No, you're wise beyond your years with a lot of what I am trying to instill in the next generation of financial professionals, just because the industry has a very loud and often told message about who you need to be for your clients and how you need to show up. And it could be because you're serving some big brand, which, to your point, may be scary, and you may need not to be around that brand. Maybe you need to do your own thing and become indispensable in that way. So, no, I love that. So I don't know the address of this quote, but you said the road to comfort is crowded and rarely gets you there. I think that has, godly, so many implications for a lot of things. But personally, my word for 2021 is patience, not just being patient with others, but also being patient with myself, if I'm being really transparent. I'm curious, what role has patience as a discipline kind of played in your life over the years as, you know, you've been putting together all these concepts? Maybe talk about patience a little bit.
Wow. Good for you for picking a good word for your mantra for the year. Here's what I don't think patience means: let yourself off the hook, take it easy, and you'll do it tomorrow. I think patience means put up with how hard it is today, because you know that if you are on the path, one day it will be worth it.
Wow.
And in that respect, you know, 7,000 blog posts, 7,500 blog posts in a row, I didn't have 100 readers after the first 200 posts, right? Almost no one gets the 200 posts, because when they get the 200 posts, they go, I don't even have 100 readers. And they stop because they didn't have patience, because it's painful at the beginning and there's no positive feedback. And the same thing's true with the, you know, I've started several internet companies, some of which have failed. And I've been in lots of projects where at the beginning, when you hit the dip, it's super easy to quit. And what patience means for me is persistence.
Sounds a lot like Mr. Gary Vee. He talks about this and talks about enjoying the process. And like, can we get to something that we do in life that we enjoy? You know, I have a 19-year-old that took a semester off from college. And she was like, Dad, you know, I want to do this whole, you know, self-employment thing. I want to try this out. And I was like, great, come back home. We'll support you. Do whatever. And she was like, you know, after a couple months, she's like, this is harder than I thought. And I'm like, yeah, it is. You can't become an overnight sensation on YouTube or any other platform without putting the work in. So I say that to say, I think a lot of what I'm seeing in a demographic that's a little younger than me, I'll be 45 in February, but it's like, I want the shorter route to success, to whatever, you know, and it doesn't have to necessarily be around money or finance. It can just be whatever they deem as success. And I think there's a level of short-sightedness in that you're kind of alluding to with this, you know, lack of persistence or absence of patience. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's short-sightedness and it's fear, because the system evolved the way it did to indoctrinate us once again to getting a day job, doing what we're told, buying the stuff that's advertised on TV, putting it in a storage unit if we have too much, and then repeating the process again tomorrow. And what has become more and more clear as people have been sharing their stories online is that the overnight successes make the newspapers, but the vast majority of people who have done something that they can point to, that's not how they got there. They toiled away in relative obscurity on something that they knew was going to be important long before the world figured out it was going to be important. And drip, drip, drip. And you got to sign up for that, or else you're better off just getting a day job.
Yeah, no. So for context, I want to set this next question. You tweeted on, I think it was like December 19th-ish, real short blog post, the way we've always done it. And so a lot of my audience are career changers, right? They've been doing something for 10, 15 years or so. And they go, you know what? This financial advice thing, this is interesting to me. I have friends that ask me about this, da, 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 da. This is all before they know how hard it is to build a business or build a brand. But that to say, let's talk about the way we've always done something, right? I think there are some non-negotiables when you're thinking about this path. Like, for instance, I tell people to get a mentor. I tell them to do plenty of research. I tell them to have a nice emergency fund runway and or a spouse that supports this. So, because you're going to have some hard times in the first 2 or 3 years. Would you add anything to that list? I know, obviously, you haven't built a financial practice, but I think you've got the wisdom to kind of speak into the life of a career changer to kind of be contemplating some things, but not be thinking about it from a traditional standpoint, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'll, this is the first time I'm disagreeing with you in the last half hour.
Okay.
The mentors are hard to find and non-scalable. It's a asymmetrical relationship that can get you stuck. I'm more of a fan of heroes than mentors. You never need to meet your heroes. In fact, you might be better off if you didn't. Find someone who's been on the path before, who has published how they did it, and then ask yourself, what would they do today? What would they do in this situation? And they don't even know you're following them, but you have a rhythm to it. But the other thing I would say to a career changer is, don't quit your day job until you've done the following. Organize 3 circles of 6 to 8 people each who meet on Zoom once a week. And you're the organizer. It can be a group of entrepreneurs. It can be a group of job seekers. It can be a group of, trust fund babies, just a group of people. And your only job is to find them, invite them, organize them, and be the host of the call. If you can't pull that off in your spare time, you should not quit your day job. Mm-hmm. If you can, it's going to be pretty straightforward for you to find a new source of clients. Because if you've surrounded yourself by these focus groups of people who are meeting with each other, who have been disconnected and are now connected, who have been lonely and are now less lonely, they're going to look to you with trust and admiration because they're going to ask you a question. And the fact that you were there at the table and have been for months, that is the key. Because here's the thing about being a personal coach or a financial planner. There are only 2 kinds of people in the world, people who know they need one and people who don't. The people who know they need one probably have one already, which means that the only way for you to get them is to get them to fire their old one. And the people who don't know they need one, it's not like they've been isolated from the world telling them they might need one. So you have to persuade someone who has previously been unpersuaded that they need one. So neither path is particularly easy. And it's the getting new clients part that is how you build a career you can point to. Well, the way you're going to get new clients is by organizing your people, not by hoping someone Googles you, finds you, beats down the door and sends you money.
No, this is interesting. So about 12 months ago, I was working with a consulting firm for financial professionals and advisors. And one of the notions that I always put forth was, okay, you just started a practice. You have no clients or very little clients. Why don't you go into Quora, get one of these topical questions, maybe create a Facebook group and show up live once a week answering everybody's questions. Well, my time is worth more than that. Well, no, it's not because you have no clients. Why don't you do that? And the reluctance of that, I think it hits a lot of chords with most people. There's the fear about, being rejected, whatnot. There's, the fear of failure personally. There's also this level of, man, this is hard work. I didn't know that it was going to take all that. I want to kind of weave into this concept of something that is really, really scary. And one of the reasons that I want to, open up these conversations, because usually you say financial advisor in a room and you scare everybody away because it's this notion around sales. And I even help younger people realize, what do you have against sales? Everything is sold. Most people are persuaded into a decision. What is your opinion on that? Because maybe hearing it from you, people will be like, oh, okay, well, now I get it.
So let's say you were a trained lifeguard on Jones Beach in New York or out on Zuma in California, and somebody was drowning. I don't think you would say, well, I'm not sure if I should jump in the water and save them because maybe they don't want me to, right? Because they need what you have. All right, that makes sense. Let's say you're a trained physician and you meet somebody and you can tell they have tuberculosis. Should you get them straight to the emergency room so they can get treatment? Or should you say, well, maybe they don't really want me to help them. They want to have to. It's pretty clear for lifeguards and doctors, there's not a lot of selling involved. It doesn't seem like. Well, one of two things is true with your ability to be a financial planner. Either you're going to give people solace, peace of mind, connection, and all the things that come with that, or you're not. If you're doing it so that you can make a commission, please don't call. But if you're doing it because somebody needs those things, well, then why do you feel like that's selling?
Yeah. I think it's a couple of things, right? The industry is fairly young, 50, almost 60 years old, and its roots were in whole life insurance products being sold or fixed products being sold. And, you know, relatively recently had this whole, you know, maybe fee only or even fee based assets under management model kind of come into play where it's a little bit more transparent, the tangible thing you're actually getting and how your advisor is being compensated. And so there's been a half a half a century of brainwashing, I think, that goes into that. But then, you know, that's the reason why I think there are programs like CFP Education and, you know, organizations like the FPA and things like that that are helping to organize or educate, rather, the newer generation. But no, I love the way that you put that, because I think it's so clear and apparent in all these other instances. Why isn't it as clear and apparent with something as dear as our money?
Yeah.
So I'm loving this conversation, man. I'm loving this.
You're really good at this. It's a pleasure.
Okay, so check this out. This is a podcast to help empower tomorrow's financial professional with tools to serve their clients in a much better and meaningful way at the next level is what I call it. In that context, what words or word of wisdom would you leave with the audience in regards to that pursuit?
Well, so what we keep touching on is whether the person who's going to be a financial planner is going to be a leader, a manager, a follower. It's interesting they're called planners, right? Because a lot of what you're pushed to do is to be a follower or maybe to manage. Manage is about authority. Manage is about getting a predicted outcome. Leadership is involves dancing on the edge and exploring new frontiers. So 2020 was the craziest year in the history of recorded history. And it's the most stable year we're ever going to have again. Because all of the systems, you know, well, now that we're working from home, how long are we going to work from home? Now that we're learning from home, how long are we going to learn from home? Now that mainstream media is officially not the dominant voice, where does that? All of these things have become unmoored. And so if you expect that 2021 is going to be like 1991, except later in history, it's not. It's going to be different in a way that no one understands. So who should we go to? Well, maybe we should go to a planner. Maybe we should find somebody who is comfortable with ambiguity and has an ability to combine passion and transparency and dignity, engaging with people around something that they've been brainwashed over their whole life. That's your job. And so it's a combination of 5-10 jobs that we all look up to. It is not about being a clerk. There are cheaper clerks than you. So if you're all you're doing, and I know people who have been financial planners for a long time, who take the memo that comes from the company they're affiliated with and send it out to all the people they send it out to and then make a commission, we don't need you to do that. We've already got a computer that can do that. You're going to have to figure out how to be in and of yourself to understand what it means to be specific. So I know that's not one word, but I felt like the question deserved more than that.
No. I think I love the tone that you're taking with this of leadership. I think at the end of the day, what my clients look to me for is, well, a better way to say this is that we're inundated with so much information now. My clients don't really need more information from me. They need a way to organize what I consider limited resources, time and money, mm-hmm. across unlimited choices. That's what they need, so that they can go be their best self and whatever else they decide to do. And I think that is somewhat lost on the profession, at least when they bring you in, because at the end of the day, they're trying to churn the numbers that they need. And they know that so many are going to come through that door and so many are going to kind of fall off. So it's really like, you know, storming the beaches of Normandy, and we got to throw as many people as we can at it. But at the end of the day, I think this is a very, very human and relational issue that we have with our money. And the next generation and even existing financial professionals need to be more leaders than followers and managers. I love that. That's great.
Yeah. And so if I could just let me put one more story on the table, which is a guy named Robert Parker started writing a newsletter years ago about wine. And he came up with the brilliant idea of giving wine a score between 0 and 100. And all of a sudden, this amorphous, unknown thing became easily metricized. And if he gave your wine a big score, your vineyard was in good shape, right? And financial services started in the opposite direction, which is it started with basis points. But what both wine and financial planning have in common is this: the absolute number is irrelevant. What we know from the Journal of Wine Economists is that in blind taste tests, sommeliers, trained sommeliers, prefer $10 bottles of wine to $100 bottles of wine every time. But guess what? No one drinks wine blindfolded. And so $100 bottles of wine actually win unblindfolded taste tests. So the question is, what kind of wine should you buy? Well, if a $100 bottle of wine makes you feel better for a whole bunch of reasons and you can afford it, that's what you should buy. And the same thing is true with a financial planner. All the basis points in the world aren't doing you any good. What you're selling is the story your customer tells their spouse and the story they tell themselves. Because they don't know what every single possibility is. All they know is what their story is. And if you're not comfortable being in the story business, you're probably not going to be a very good financial planner.
Wow, that's a soundbite. If you're not comfortable being in the story business, you're not going to be a good planner. I love that. It is about telling stories. You're right. It's about telling not only your own personal story so that you can persuade your prospect, but also finding out how they intersect. And they may not. It's like your planner friend that, you know, he has the violinist and the, you know, all these as his niche, if you will. That's what we call it. But, you know, if they don't fit that specialty, that's okay. I mean, like, what do you need? Maybe 150 clients to really have a great practice and a great life, especially if you want some balance in it. So I love that. Man, this has been great. I think you are one of the world's great educators with the ability to put things that are somewhat complicated and, you know, a little vague into real concrete, you know, things that we can bite size and take away. So great stuff, Seth.
Very kind of you. It's fun to talk.
All right. Good stuff. Thank you. I appreciate you.
Thanks, Dominique. We'll see you soon.
Hey there. I really hope you enjoyed this conversation. Before we go, just a few things. The best way to retain what you just learned is to do more than just listen. First, you need to write down your most important takeaway, and then you need to give yourself a deadline to apply it. For bonus points, you might also let someone hold you accountable to that deadline. Also, remember, the only way more people will know about this podcast is if you share it. You can do that by sharing a link to this episode on your social media or by leaving a review on iTunes so that it reaches a wider audience. I'd appreciate if you took the time to do either or both. And finally, if you'd like to join my free community to learn more about how you can become a next generation financial professional, please text me at 214-544-9226. I love to hear from you and point you in the right direction. Bye for now. Until our next conversation. Mm-hmm.